Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the state of Obama's foreign policy pivot towards Asia on the eve of his eight-day trip starting on Tuesday to Japan, South Korea, Malaysia, and the Philippines. Steve Clemens, the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live, who co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute, joins us to discuss what appears to the Chinese to be a policy of containing them and the failed reset of relations with Russia now that Obama seems to have written off Putin as we head in the direction of a new Cold War with a containment policy to isolate and make Russia a pariah state. Then we will speak with a leading international expert on contemporary Ukraine, Taras Kuzio, who is a fellow with the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. We will look into the shaky truce between armed separatists in eastern Ukraine and a weak, inept government in Kiev trying to exert authority over restive provinces thoroughly infiltrated by Russian intelligence and paramilitary forces who appear to have staged a shooting at a checkpoint given the speed with which the Russian TV network controlled by Putin's close friend Dmitry Kislyov showed up at the scene and stoked outrage across the Russian media. Then finally, we'll discuss the Detroit bankruptcy and the change of fortune for the city's pensioners who previously were going to get pennies on the dollar while the banks who entangled Detroit in risky financial deals that blew up in the 2008 Wall Street crash were about to be made largely whole. A former investment banker at Goldman Sachs, Wallace Turberville, now a senior fellow at Demos and author of their report, The Detroit Bankruptcy, joins us to discuss this turnaround and what is behind it. And joining us now is Steve Clemens, who is a Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation, and previously Steve Clemens co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. Welcome to Background Briefing, Steve Clemens.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And I guess it does seem like a pretty harsh critique of the president to suggest that his two main foreign policy initiatives of late, the pivot towards Asia and the reset of Russia, both seem to be largely in trouble. Let's begin with the pivot to Asia. You've had the administration being, instead of getting out of the Middle East and Russia and Eastern Europe, they are getting dragged further in. Congressional Democrats have blocked Obama's bid for the 12-nation Pacific Free Trade Pact. Obama's had to cancel participation in two Asian summits because of government shutdowns last fall. So what do you think he could achieve on this trip to Japan, South Korea, Malaysia, and the Philippines, given that China, in its recent trip of Vice President Biden and his Chinese counterpart, accused and threatened, saying that, with Chuck Hagel, the Chinese defense minister said, you're never going to be able to contain us. And that appears to be what the Chinese think Obama's pivot's all about.
Well, an explicit containment of China would be very complicated because China is the kind of growing state that's just embedded everywhere now today. And I think it's going to be hard to do that. But nonetheless, I think that, you know, maintaining a relatively strong presence in Asia has been a strategic priority of the Obama administration. And as you've said, it's been a very, very tough go because, you know, life and global problems happen and they compel the White House to react. And I think what Obama's been trying to do, and I think he's had relative success, more success than I think critics give him so far, is while he has to pay attention to Ukraine and while he has to sort of look at broader issues in the Middle East, he's not been deploying new troops there. He's not been, you know, doing what George W. Bush would have done and what John McCain and other Republican critics have wanted him to do, which is to throw everything he has into these crises that are not on the strategic map that he wants to go. And so I think, you know, Chuck Hagel, Joe Biden, Barack Obama have been trying to, you know, tell allies in Asia that America will maintain a strong presence during a time of budget drawdown and during a time when withdrawals from Afghanistan are underway, and try not to be sucked deeply into other problems. And notice I said the word deeply because they are being sucked in somewhat. And I think he has to thread that needle very carefully between not becoming an overly reactive president to everything and trying to maintain some strategic contours of what his foreign policy is about.
But it does seem, Steve Clements, that all of the stops on Obama's trip starting on Tuesday to Asia, Japan, followed by South Korea, Malaysia, and then finally the Philippines, all of those nations have one thing in common, which is that they have territorial disputes with China, largely over rocks, what is often called piles of rocks in the South China Sea.
Absolutely. I mean, the level of Chinese propaganda efforts to sort of assert that all of the South China Sea is part of its historic sovereignty have been remarkable. And as you recall, I went with Joe Biden on his plane and covered the Biden trip to Asia in December. And while it wasn't exactly the same countries we were in China, Japan, and Korea, and at that time you had President Park in Korea and Prime Minister Abe in Japan, who hadn't spent more than 30 seconds on stage with each other, who really deeply dislike one another. So part of what is driving the president's trip is assuring erstwhile allies that America is going to maintain a presence and to try to send a signal to China, because he's not stopping in China, that America is engaged and will be there. Whether that's puffery or not, we'll have to wait and see. But I think also part of it is to get these countries to deal with each other more responsibly. We have a trade deal, as you said, has been scuttled for the time being in the Congress, not a lot of support there. So the president can't go and give that gift. But, I mean, you and I and Chalmers Johnson talked many, many times about Japanese kind of mercantilism that continues without a lot of attention. And, you know, yet again, it's kind of a playback to the 1980s. Japan's auto market sector, which, you know, remains relatively impervious to U.S. exports and European exports to some degree, is the sticking point for the Japanese in TPP, which many people projected it would be. So that's you know, really hampering the president's opportunities there. And then on the security front, there, whether or not I think the president is sort of maintaining an Asia focus, much of the world doesn't think that. And that's the problem. There's a perception gap between the credibility and solvency of an Asia pivot and what people see as an inchoate kind of commitment to the region.
But given that relations between Japan and South Korea are at their lowest point, as many have argued, since World War II, and now that Japan, with its assertive right-wing government, are now planning to put a military radar station about 90 miles from the Senkaku island group claimed by China at this new base on Yonaguni Island, how is that going to, obviously the Chinese will respond fairly forcefully, will they not?
It makes everything worse. I mean, they're going to station about 150 troops there at full force in this exchange, in this new radar facility that's being talked about. And the defense minister, Onodera, has come out and said that, you know, he thought that an expansion of these military posts for the so-called defense of Japan could be expanded to other islands. So it has thrown something that used to be in a balance and kind of had an equilibrium with a lot of ambiguity. While Japan and China both play to the darkest nationalists in each of their quarters, it is driving and escalating national impulses that very well could take Japan and China into an unintended conflict where the two barely talk with each other, and could create not only a conflict between themselves, but something that draws the United States in by treaty. It's one of the most scary fault lines in the world today. And I think that Vice President Biden, when he was there in December, tried to get these leaders to think more maturely and you know, frankly, you know, less recklessly about the words they use, about their calls, you know, on historical memory, and about their accusations. And as Chalmers Johnson and I used to argue, there is a downside to American military presence in the region, that if China, Japan, and Korea believe fundamentally that the United States will, at its core, prevent conflict in the region, then that allows those leaders to be incredibly reckless with their rhetoric, with their posturing, with the kinds of things they're doing. And it's lending itself to things like we're seeing with this radar installation, which is changing the status quo regarding these islands that have, you know, disputed claims over them. I think China's doing the same thing, but nobody really knows how it's all started now. One is blaming the other. It's moving in dangerous territory.
Well, it does seem in many ways that here we are about to have the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War One, where diplomatic failures and blunders led to the war to end all wars, which was a huge cauldron of death and destruction, completely unnecessary, completely avoidable, but largely the great powers were sucked in because of their entangled alliances and relations with surrogates. So to what extent do you think that we could get sucked into larger conflicts, both in Ukraine if there's a civil war and there's a great deal of alarm over Putin's recent remarks about Novorossiya, and there's a sense that in the Baltics of concern that all of the Russian minorities in those countries could be stirred up. So you have that potential crisis erupting in Europe. And then you've got the idea that we do have agreements with some of these countries like Japan, do we not? That if they provoke something with China, what do we do?
Ian, you've hit the target right on the head. And David Ignatius in the Washington Post yesterday, folks can Google it, wrote a piece about the battle of men in preceding the World War One who wanted to seem bold and strong and unyielding, and how this escalatory masculinity that was part of the leadership circles of the early 20th century and a lot of other structural factors seem so similar to some of what was driving in Ukraine. His focus was on Ukraine, not Asia, and particularly Putin's behavior. And he said, we may be very lucky that Barack Obama seems like, you know, the kid with his shirt, you know, tied up to the top, sitting up, you know, sort of like a nerd in the front of the room who understands that strategic restraint has to be part of the picture of these cases. But I have to say that both in Asia and with some of what we've seen in Ukraine, too many of the patterns, too much of the posturing, a lot of the media attention, a lot of the public reaction, not just, you know, here, but, you know, when you look inside Russia, you look inside the different factions inside Ukraine, you look at the debates within Japan, within Korea, and within China, between what I would call healthy nationalists and dark nationalists, it has a feel as if each of these steps that are being taken are so symbolic and so imbued with importance for domestic political ramifications in each of these respective countries that it has a 1914 feel. And we should all be very, very worried about it. And then when you see some of the criticism of the president for not getting up, not throwing everything he had at Vladimir Putin, not starting a war or throwing, you know, large-scale military weapons into Ukraine, that people look at this as a sign of appeasement and a sign of weakness. I tell people, be worried about the 1914 model. Be very worried, because we could be, as you said, over a pile of rocks or over issues that have dynamics that have nothing to do with us, particularly inside Ukraine. It's very important to give people an opportunity for leadership, but as I think John Kerry said the other day, there's some nasty sides to this Ukrainian dimension. We had some towns with Jewish residents inside Ukraine issued notices that they would have to start identifying themselves and wearing identification. This has rings of the 1930s, and we all should be worried. I think you hit it right on the head.
Well, what do you think then, and what do you make of the New York Times story on Sunday, a front page story about how the Obama administration seemed to have written off Putin, and that we may be heading into
Peter Baker's story, I think.
Yes, that's right.
Peter Baker of the New York Times has written something which I think it has a couple of components to it. One, that Obama has decided that despite the best efforts of the administration, that Putin has decided to be the naughty guy in class and to identify himself and define himself by the trouble he can make. I think that may be a mistake, but what I found interesting is that it goes on to say that though we will never have a constructive relationship with Putin, it doesn't say we can't be engaged with Russia. It does say we're going to engage, try to institutionalize a containment strategy a la George Kennan, which will be a mix of containment and a mix of engagement. Now, what I find potentially useful about this is that while I don't think Ukraine per se can be saved. I think it's been a mistake for some time to think, whether it was over LGBT issues or, you have to go back to what Putin is doing inside his country. When you look at what happened with Pussy Riot, what you saw happening with various critics of the Putin administration inside Russia, a lot of what he's doing externally, I believe, has to do with mollifying a domestic population and keeping himself from becoming politically vulnerable inside Russia. That said, Russia seems to have lots of pressure points with us, and the United States and the West seem to have very few pressure points with Russia. And I think that it's been a mistake to silo each problem or challenge we have with Russia, whether it's Syria or dealing with issues in the North China Sea or the North Pacific, dealing with Iran matters, or dealing, you know, now with Ukraine and kind of Moldova and some of this kind of ethnic nationalism with Russia to the rescue, if you will. I think we don't have a lot of leverage points. We've been dealing with each of the square on the chessboard unto itself without looking more broadly. I don't want to see Russia, I don't want to see Russia in essentially demonized to such a point where we can't engage it. I see that happening in the United States. But I think the Peter Baker piece says that essentially the administration realizes finally that it needs to realize it has a global game going on with Russia, and it needs to find where those leverage points are. My hope is that they couple that with the notion that no matter who the leader of is Russia, they've got to try to work on developing a constructive relationship with Russia, because it is one of the great global stakeholders. Lots of nuclear weapons, member of the Permanent Five, important global economy, important oil and energy and gas producer in the world. All of those issues make Russia a nation you can't avoid dealing with. So they've got to find something that's better. And I worry a little bit about these stories that come out saying, oh, now we're going to have an era where we're only tough on Russia. That's not realistic. It's very naive.
But is there a way that you can be tough on Putin and not tough on Russia? I mean, Putin is clearly has changed the subject and is distracting the Russian people from his own kleptocracy, albeit the Ukrainian situation exploded over his kleptocrat that he had in Ukraine, who just got too greedy. But
yeah, I mean,
obviously,
Putin has a big series of kleptocrats around him. And I think that, however, I mean, one of my small differences with the administration on what it has done, and, you know, people disagree, is that despite sanctioning, and that means constraining the resources and the options and the travel of the cronies around Putin, that may play well domestically, but it's not taken seriously. I mean, part of what's going on in Russia is that Russians, he's very popular with basic Russians. He looks to them, if you will, like their Ronald Reagan, who's taking a problematic country and reasserting Russia as a great state in the world. And it's morning in Moscow. And so when a great state like that sees the United States sanction individuals, it's not perceived as serious. If we had sanctioned sectors in ways that, you know, possibly cause some harm, we're trying to deter Russia on the cheap. And I think that was a big mistake. I think we should not have gone after individuals and sanctions as we did, or if we did, at least couple them to sectoral reforms. But we thought by basically just dealing with Putin, the mobster, with the mob connections, if you will, with various oligarchs that are his pals and buddies, that that would change the direction of the nation. And I think that really was a mistake and underestimated the resolve that Putin has in his legacy building to go down in history in Russia as the guy who restored some semblance of what the Soviets were.
But just in closing, Steve Clements, how much is Putin really about making Russia greater and stronger and more solvent and more democratic? Let's forget that one. But or how much is he, as he appears to be, somewhat obsessed with trying to not so much build Russia up, but tear America down? I mean, the story that Hank Paulson told about the Chinese at the time of the 2008 crash coming to him, saying that Putin was trying to get them, the Chinese, to dump all of their Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac holdings, which would have completely tanked the economy. If there's any truth to that, this guy...
I think they're tied together. I think he would like to see the United States humiliated and weakened. And so that's one of the reasons why they've been playing tough in Syria. They're trying to find points that I think humiliate, that bring down the United States a notch, because he believes the United States humiliated the Soviet Union, showed significant amounts of disrespect, and his job now is to reassert Russian confidence and status in the world. And so these are combined, and with the oil and energy and gas resources he has, which are enormous, and the ability to put pressure on key strategic relationships that the United States has with countries like Japan and with Europe, notwithstanding the eastern parts of Europe that are such big consumers of Russian product and Russian gas supplies, that he thinks that he can gain leverage in those relationships and weaken the ties between some of these allies in the United States. It is a very, very tough time because, as you know, Europe is on the edge of a deflationary black hole, and the United States is not growing robustly. And if you don't have money and resources that can support your foreign policy and national security strategy globally, other nations will take advantage of it. And that's what he's doing. So he's using this moment to basically push chips around the world that are tied to both, which is a resurgent Russia and at the same time tied to some degree to humiliating the United States where he can. And to a certain degree, he's succeeding here and there, not completely, but that's what his agenda is.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Steve Clemens.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Steve Clemens, who is the Washington Editor-at-Large for The Atlantic and Editor-in-Chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation. And previously, Steve Clemens co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with a leading international expert on contemporary Ukraine.
Depends on who. I'm gonna get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself alone. Get you and keep you in my arms evermore. Leave all the others waiting on a faraway shore.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Taras Kuzio, who is a leading international expert on contemporary Ukraine and post-communist politics, nationalism, and European integration at the Center for Political and Regional Studies in the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies at the University of Alberta. He is a fellow with the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. And his latest book is Commissars into Oligarchs, A Contemporary History of Ukraine. Welcome to Background Briefing, Taras Kuzio.
Hi, welcome. Hello.
And this shaky truce that's underway now has been broken by an incident at a checkpoint controlled by these armed pro-Russian militants. But there's a lot of suspicion to the extent to which it may have been the work of the GRU, Russian military intelligence, given the speed with which the Russian TV network controlled by Putin's close friend Dmitry Kislyov showed up at the scene and stoked outrage across the Russian media. So what's your understanding of what happened there and what its ramifications will be?
Well, the Ukraine Security Service have openly stated that the only individuals in that region were pro-Russian armed separatists. The Ukrainian far-right organization called Right Sector has also said that they were not involved. Ukrainian internet social media is full of bloggers and other people who are openly ridiculing the Russian accusations. Computer geeks have had a field day doing various cartoons about the so-called Ukrainian national involvement in a whole history of incidents throughout the world in the last 30 years. They seem to be accused of everything these days. They're the bogeyman. So it's become a bit of a source of ridicule. This very much would seem to be, particularly because, as you said, the Russians seem to have the press release already ready before the incident, a preconceived provocation, an attempt to blame the Ukrainians' side to use the sort of nationalist bogeyman, as it was a bogeyman in the Soviet Union, and now with the new neo-Soviet regime in Moscow, a new bogeyman, to blame the Ukrainians for destroying the truce during the Easter weekend, which, is very sacred for Orthodox and Catholic Christians. So it just seems a complete provocation. Unfortunately, though, the worst part of this is that because the media sphere in Russia is so controlled by Putin these days, even more than it was a few years ago, that many Russians will come to believe this, because this is the only source of information that they have.
Well, what is do you think is the story behind this incident that took place at various synagogues, particularly in Donetsk, where a lot of people now are speculating that because the head of the CIA made a trip recently to Kiev, which was not a secret trip, and then shortly thereafter, this incident blows up, and some are suggesting that this was a kind of an American-inspired psyop. But our previous guests and John Kerry himself still insist that it was as it happened, a manifestation of poisonous anti-Semitism amongst these Russian nationalists in eastern Ukraine.
Well, I mean, the idea is absolutely ludicrous that the head of the CIA would be somehow linking his visit to Kiev with the issuing of anti-Semitic leaflets in Donetsk. I mean, I've never been a spook in my life, but this doesn't seem to be the way that intelligence field works. The reason why it became known that the head of the CIA visited Kiev is because obviously the Ukrainians and the CIA and the American government wanted it to be known. I'm sure if he wanted to do a secret visit to Kiev, he could have done. But this was obviously leaked out as a potential warning to Putin that the American side is actually considering more than just diplomatic sanctions and accusations and condemnations, but also thinking of maybe, for example, exchange of intelligence, surveillance, and potentially down the road even supply of defensive military equipment. This is all part of the process of international kind of signaling and deliberate leaking. Now, the leaflet in Donetsk has nothing to do with this. This is, when I was in Kiev, I just came back 2 days ago, a colleague of mine who's an American who reports from Kiev for a Western newspaper had just returned from Donetsk, and he said he was astounded at the level of a kind of very perverse anti-Semitism amongst these pan-Slavic Russian nationalists in Donetsk. That's not surprising. Donetsk is very similar in its national identity to the Crimea, where you have this very curious blend of Russian, pan-Slavic, and Soviet nationalism, and where anti-Semitism historically, both in the Tsarist era and in the Soviet Union, where it was disguised as anti-Zionism, was always a very deeply felt question. And this has probably been stirred up as well by the Russians against local oligarchs in eastern Ukraine, many of whom do have Jewish background, as they do in Russia. And the reason why this is the case is that the Russians and the Russian regime is particularly wanting to stir up anti-oligarch sentiment in eastern Ukraine, because they're very afraid that the oligarchs there will strike some deal with Kiev over the heads of the protesters, as indeed is what has happened in neighboring region of Dnipropetrovsk, which is headed by oligarch Igor Kolomoisky. So I think this is part and parcel of Russian strategy. It sometimes goes out of control because the locals espouse what they really believe, this sort of curious blend of pro-Russian, pro-Soviet, anti-Semitism, but and then Russian nationalism. But it's part and parcel of that sort of field of ideology. I don't think it's anything to do with the American side or the Ukrainian side.
So what, though, this very weak government in Kiev clearly did, in their attempt to exert authority over the East, certainly floundered. And it's pretty clear to me that the East and probably most of Ukraine is thoroughly infiltrated by Russian and intelligence and paramilitary forces. So what is likely to happen going forward here, given that it's pretty clear, I think, that Putin does not want this May 25th election to take place? So Obama, of course, in commenting on the so-called truce that was announced in Geneva by the foreign ministers, he was pretty skeptical about it. So what's your reading on where things stand and where they're likely to head?
Well, everybody's skeptical, as they rightly should be. We're still waiting, and the European Union and the U.S. are still waiting for Russia to implement the agreement signed with the European Union over Georgia 6 years ago. But then the West didn't accuse Russia of being deceitful and lying. Today it is. When I've met Western diplomats in Kiev just a few days ago, they said openly to me they don't believe a word that's coming out of Moscow anymore. I receive a daily briefing from the U.S. State Department which counteracts against a whole host of Russian lies. And this is unprecedented that international diplomats are openly and publicly saying that another country, this case Russia, is just not saying anything truthful. Now, on the question of Eastern Ukraine, I think it's an exaggeration to say everything is lost. Yes, it's a very weak government in Kiev because of financial, economic reasons. At the same time, the opinion polls show two things very important, that support for the separation of regions in eastern and southern Ukraine, which is primarily Russian-speaking, and support for some kind of federalism is extremely low throughout the region. What you've actually got is a higher level of support for that in Donetsk and Luhansk. Together they call the Donbass. And that's why Russia did begin this process of infiltration of eastern Ukraine in those two regions, because those two regions I mentioned before are very similar to the Crimea in terms of their national identity. But that's not been the case. There hasn't been evidence really of support elsewhere in eastern and southern Ukraine. Now, what we have is, in effect, a silent majority throughout that region. They don't like what's going on with these armed separatists and Russian intervention, but they also don't particularly like what's happened in Kiev either. So they've kind of become ambivalent and neutral. And in the meantime, a minority, with the help of green men from Russia or the Crimea, are taking charge and are causing havoc and taking charge of local situation, with the help, by the way, as in the Crimea, with the leader of the Crimea, Mr. Aksyonov, whose criminal name is Goblin, with the help of local organized crime. So you have this a minority imposing its will on the majority, which doesn't like them and doesn't like what's going on in Kiev. And that minority is composed of Russian green men, local organized crime, and some local pro-Russian nationalists. The Kiev response has been feeble. I've never been in the military myself, but I think I would have not sent in armored personnel carriers into a crowded place full of civilians, especially because these green men and these so-called tough Russian nationalists were hiding behind unarmed civilians. So that they were mistaken. But at the same time, there seems to be, according to the Ukrainian media, a very good record of capturing. They are detaining quite a lot of people. They are capturing a lot of weapons still coming in. The Geneva Agreement didn't stop any of this. The flow of weapons and explosives into Ukraine has continued. And, of course, the local separatists have just begun echoing Russian demands, which are for regime change in Kiev and for no elections to take place. So it does. I think that people in Kiev do come across as feeble, in one stage. But on the other hand, they don't want to give Russia the excuse for intervention with massive bloodshed of civilians. And they also want to kind of keep the peace as much as possible so that the elections can go ahead in approximately 5 weeks' time. So it's a very difficult balancing act.
But just looking at the broader picture, Taras Kuzio, we were talking earlier about the possible analogies to the build-up of World War I, given the 100th anniversary is coming up in August of this year. And Graham Allison at Harvard has written a piece suggesting that civil war in Ukraine could break out and could affect the Baltic regions, Poland, the Czech Republic, all of whom are quite concerned about Putin and his statements about his right to intervene in Ukraine and his reference to Novorossiya. So give us a sense then of how these and alliances and entanglements might unravel and what could be done to avoid that World War One scenario.
Well, the only thing, and I'm not trying to be a sort of a hardliner here, but the only thing the Russians understand is toughness. And that's why they laugh at the European Union, sadly. It's an institution with 28 members that finds it very difficult to reach a decision. They are afraid of the U.S., but less so of President Obama than, say, would have been of President Clinton or President Bush. So toughness is required. That means doing a whole host of things, such as, according to U.S. legislation, Putin is an exporter of terrorism. Declare him or threaten to declare him as an exporter of terrorism to other countries. In other words, he's a leader of a terrorist organization. Secondly,
which specifically, what terrorism are you referring to?
Well, terrorism into eastern Ukraine and into the Crimea. And Russia has a record of doing this, of course, in Georgia, in Azerbaijan, and in Moldova. I mean, Ukraine is not the only place that Russia's undertaking a policy of supporting frozen conflicts or annexation of other countries' territories. And Russia's also undertaken terrorist acts in the Middle East against Chechen leaders who were there in exile. So there has been analysis by a professor from Rutgers University called Alexander Mottl, who wrote in the journal World Affairs Journal just recently, a few weeks ago, where he cited American legislation on how to define a country or entity or individuals involved in exporting terrorism. Putin fits the bill. Use that as a threat. Another threat that's that potentially could be used is against the $40 billion he's allegedly stashed in Switzerland and elsewhere in the West. Putin is the wealthiest individual in Russia. It's not Oleg Deripaska, the Russian oligarch. It's actually Putin. Threaten his assets, his personal assets. Make him persona non grata. Expand the list. There are a lot more tougher things. Hold PFP. Ukraine has been a very active member for two decades now of NATO's Partnership for Peace program. Hold PFP exercises on the Russian-Ukrainian border, bringing foreign troops. I don't think so much Central Eastern Europe is threatened by what's happening in Ukraine, but certainly the three Baltic states, which were part of the USSR, an entity that, of course, Vladimir Putin thinks was regretfully disallowed to disintegrate, and the worst disaster in the 20th century, according to him. So certainly three Baltic states are going to feel very threatened now, especially because Latvia, for example, has more Russian speakers than Ukraine. Half of the population of Latvia are Russian speakers. You will hear more Russian in Riga than you will hear in Kiev. And in Latvia and Estonia, most of those, approximately two-thirds of the Russian speakers in both of those countries still don't have citizenship because of the very peculiar German, old-style German ethnic laws on acquiring citizenship. So the threat is potentially there. I don't think it's necessarily a threat to Poland or Romania. They're just too big members of NATO. But certainly to Moldova, Baltic states, northern Kazakhstan. One has to adopt a tough position, already set a real red line in the sand. Otherwise, we are going to have a repeat, of course, of the 1930s.
Well, just in closing, though, Taras Kuzio, it's one thing to get tough with Putin and another thing to get tough with the Russian people, who apparently do feel a collective sense of humiliation. And that and Putin may be using that cynically, but the fact remains that the Russian people feel that they have been humiliated and mistreated. So what do you do to address that rather than inflame the situation?
In any strong measures against undertaken, these have to be stressed to be that they are undertaking against the Russian leadership, not against Russia as a country, not against the Russian people. But beyond that, it's extremely difficult to put one's view across when the Russian media space, even more than it was even a few years ago, is so totally controlled by the Kremlin. And we do have propaganda, as European Union and American leaders have said, the propaganda spewing out of Moscow these days is worse than at the heights of the Cold War. So, yes, the Russian people feel aggrieved to some degree about what happened, but that's partly as a result of the very lopsided and lack of access to alternative sources of information that they've been given. What the Russian people should be looking at more, and this is something that could be broadcast through Western radio stations and other forms of sources of information, maybe through the internet and elsewhere, is the fact that the Russian leadership itself is the one that's betraying the country through terrible demographic crisis, terrible levels of corruption, far worse than anything in the 1990s, and that the Russia of today is actually a declining and dying great power. It's not something that can attract other countries. And during the Cold War, the USSR was a source of inspiration, whether we like it or not, for a whole host of people throughout the world. That's not the case today. So it's a rather bizarre situation where many Russians feel very proud of a country that's actually in terminal decline and where the population is going to decline terribly and where the average life expectancy is on the level of somewhere like Bangladesh. So I think we need to point these things out. We need to point out that anything we're doing tough is against the Russian leadership and not against the Russian people or the Russian state itself. That's going to be a tough measure when the Russian media space is so tightly controlled, and even to the extent that the Russian equivalent of Facebook, which is called VKontakte, which has more viewers than Facebook in Russia, was actually just recently taken over by the Kremlin. That's the degree to which they are controlling the media space, in some ways even more than the last few decades of the USSR.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Taras Kuzio.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Taras Kuzio, who's a leading international expert on contemporary Ukrainian and post-communist politics, nationalism and European integration at the Center for Political and Regional Studies in the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies at the University of Alberta. He's a fellow with the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. And his latest book is Commissars into Oligarchs, A Contemporary History of Ukraine. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into the turnaround in terms of the Detroit bankruptcy.
My half breed, all the sea. You're our fan, prophecy. Our destiny, we will not hide when the sun comes up. It will be on your side.
Just waiting for bread. Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. brother, can you spare a dime?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Wallace Turberville, who's a senior fellow at Demos. He was an investment banker at Goldman Sachs and Company for 12 years, then a visiting scholar at the Roosevelt Institute, where he authored nearly 30 articles concerning financial reform, energy, and environment. He then joined Better Markets, Inc., where he proposed rules and authored studies to implementing the Dodd-Frank Act at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, Securities and Exchange Commission, and the Financial Stability Oversight Council, and the Federal Prudential Banking regulators. He has testified on financial reform issues before the permanent subcommittees on investigations of the U.S. Senate Committee on Homeland Security and the Governmental Affairs and the House Financial Services Committee, and is the author of a report at Demos, The Detroit Bankruptcy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wallace Turberville.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
And what explains this turnaround in Detroit, where the pensioners were going to really take a haircut and only get this is the police and fire pensioners of the city of Detroit? They were only going to get pennies on the dollars, and the banks were going to largely be made whole. And I remember talking to you at the time, but it looks like you and others have intervened, and there's been quite a turnaround where the pensioners are going to get most of their pensions back. And I'm not sure about what's happening with the banks, but explain what's happening if you can, Wallace Turberville.
Well, yes, it's a bit of a curiosity, actually, except that I think there is an explanation. I think that what one must view this as is an indication that the whole bankruptcy has been really part of a political process. The city of Detroit was taken over by an emergency manager appointed by the governor, and there are different parties in control of the state house and traditionally in the city of Detroit. So that at the outset of the whole episode, the situation that was really happening on the ground there in Detroit was skewed in terms of public relations by the emergency manager to, you know, sort of improve his credibility. He's not a democratically elected official, and in order to set the stage for negotiation. And I think that's one of the things we were able to point up when we did our report. The information was coming exclusively from the emergency manager at that time, and it was, I think, useful to have a critical analysis of that so that a better balanced description of what the situation was. They tried to say that the pensions were in much worse shape than they were, and they were trying to downplay the situation with the banks. So that sort of imbalance has been redressed a great deal in recent days.
So what is then the motives there? If you've got a fairly ideological Republican governor, and Detroit is the red state part of Detroit is a rural area, and the blue state are the urban areas, in particular Detroit. So it looks as if there's a real political game going on here, and the bankruptcy person that the governor hired seemed to have been. Many people argued, in fact, that the whole bankruptcy of Detroit itself was unnecessary. That this was something that the governor forced on Detroit in effect for political reasons to punish this Democratic stronghold. Is there anything to that?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what his motive was, but one the opportunity that presented itself was to use a bankruptcy process where a lot of things can get changed to remake the political structure there, and it has a lot to do with public employee unions, which is one reason they were so aggressive in the first months with regard to the pensions, threatening huge cuts to pension benefits. And so the notion was that it was a crisis, but there was opportunity in the crisis to redo those things and change some of the balance of power with regard to public employees. And that just simply couldn't hold water. There's an election this coming autumn where the governor's up. So I think what happened is that some of the political forces sort of rebalanced over time. Now, the question whether bankruptcy was the solution to the city is a really interesting one. I think it's fair to say that the whole thing could have been handled differently with cooperation and sort of constructive cooperation from the state government. Perhaps no bankruptcy, certainly maintaining a democratically elected government in the city could have, even if they went through bankruptcy, would have made things more legitimate, if you will, for the people of Detroit. And so whichever way they went, whether it was a sort of a readjustment of things through a constructive engagement between the city and the state, or in fact even a bankruptcy filing, if that was the way it went, would have worked out better. The whole process has been really something. They're up to $100 million of expenses that legal expenses and consulting fees and all the rest that the city's gone through because of this sort of arduous process. So, there's several different possible outcomes, but I guess that in the final analysis, since the sort of the forces of good common sense and doing the right thing have sort of rebalanced, at least the outcome is much better than it would have been.
Well, it's worth noting for the audience, Wallace Turberville, the mayor of Detroit, who made all these shaky and shady deals with Wall Street just before the crash, he's in jail, of course. And the banker who made the deal, who was with the city, who made the deal, is now working for one of the banks. So there's a reasons to be sort of skeptical about that. But where did in this new realignment, where the pensioners are going to be largely made whole, and presumably the banks who were previously going to be made whole at the expense of the pensioners will be getting less. How do they manage to find some extra money here? And they've been able to save the collection at the Detroit Institute of Art and adding more than $800 million to the pensions with money from charitable foundations and the state, which is yet to approve these funds. So we're not out of the woods, are we?
We're not, because the money from the charitable trusts is contingent on the state making a contribution. And the governor said he would do that, but it has to pass through the legislature. So it's not like this is in the can, as it were. Things have to fall in place for it all to work. But one must credit the bankruptcy judge, Judge Rhodes, who did several things. There was a big derivatives transaction that the emergency manager tried to settle for a large sum of money instead of really challenging, and the judge wouldn't let him do that. Kept sending him back for more and more negotiation. The judge, Judge Rhodes, and his associates, Judge Rosen, were instrumental in working with these charitable trusts to get them involved. So the judges themselves, the judiciary has been, while not perfect, have really been very constructive in how they approach things and haven't simply taken what the emergency manager wanted and just implemented it. They've been very very activist and in many respects in a very positive way for the city. So one must give them credit, too, for getting beyond sort of a more passive approach to what their job was, to be more active and involved to try to make this thing come out right.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, I wanted to mention, of course, you'll be speaking at the UCLA Hammer Forum coming up a week from Thursday, May the 1st at 7:30 p.m., which I'll be hosting, From Wall Street to Main Street, A Case for Community Banking. Now, why is it that the U.S. is unique amongst the advanced democracies of not having an infrastructure bank, a public infrastructure bank, which would have certainly helped in this case with Detroit, why there are so few community banks, except for, say, the Bank of North Dakota?
Well, there's been a tremendous concentration of in the financial sector that's occurred over the last 30, 35 years. We elected to move in the direction of deregulation and, of course, the elimination of Glass-Steagall, which separated investment banking and commercial banking, which has caused the two together has caused this huge concentration of capital and power in a relatively small number of banks, and has given us a situation where these banks are no longer responsive to the needs of state and local regions or even small business. So things have gotten very, very big and very, very concentrated, actually very, very profitable for the big banks. But we have a hard time deciding to direct capital towards things like infrastructure, frankly, things like education, certainly addressing climate change. And it has a lot to do with income disparity as well, as it turns out. So the fact of the matter is some move toward decentralizing the way the financial sector works would be very good for the public and certainly very good for state and local governments who are really on the front line. They're sort of the first responders for some of these requirements that take long, you know, it's long-term investment as opposed to very short-term investment trading decisions, high-frequency trading, that sort of thing. So we've wandered away from that for a few decades now, and the time is more than right to try to think about how ways to reverse that, and state banks, community banks are a good way to do that.
So what's your sense just in the last minute of whether or not we're heading in that direction, that there's a move afoot out there to change, to help Main Street and not reward Wall Street?
Well, there's a lot of talk about it. I'm afraid that there's less activity than there should be. So the event that we're going to be at is a good forum for trying to move that conversation along. I think that at some point we have to, as a nation, figure out how to make good long-term decisions, and that's just that it comes down to that. And
sure.
if we don't move it along, we've got problems that will just keep snowballing. So I don't think we have much choice,
sure.
but I think we'd all be served by moving along in a practical way much more effectively.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Wallace Turberville, again, the senior
fellow. I enjoyed it.
Again, thank you, Wallace. Again, a senior fellow at DeMos, who was an investment banker at Goldman Sachs for 12 years. He's also testified before the permanent subcommittees at the U.S. Senate and the House Financial Services Committee, and is the author of a report at DeMos, The Detroit Bankruptcy. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'll be back again tomorrow. Bye for now. Bye.